And this is episode 233 of The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. PRN.fm has voicemail at 862-800-6805. So leave a message or a question there. Also leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. And remember, I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners. Don't be shy. And if I've talked to an author for which I have essentially reviewed a book, I've mentioned a book, I may very well have a review copy. After I've read it, I have no need to keep it. So if you'd like a review copy of a book from one of my shows, just write to me and maybe I'll mail it to you if it's still around. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Or you can commit to monthly donations at patreon.com or liberapay.com, where we are also Infectious Myth, one word. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on any topic on which you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Now for some feedback. Actually, quite a lot. Only a couple of questions, comments, but a little involved. Diana wrote, "Are the tests being used to confirm measles not reliable? Thank you." So this was quite a while ago when I talked about measles, but I did a bit of poking around. This is not the kind of thing where standard scientific papers help, because often the diagnostic standards are defined by public health organizations like CDC, WHO, etc. Somebody may publish a new test in a scientific journal, but it would be a public health organization that says, okay, now we're going to use this test, and these are the circumstances under which you use it. Here we think there's a risk of false positive. You should run the test twice on two different blood samples. Whatever standards they develop are generally published by them and not published in scientific papers. So as I expected, the Mayo Clinic stated that the diagnosis of measles is usually by symptoms. For example, the rash. They also noted that measles is easily confused with other things. CDC confirmed this, but noted that an ELISA antibody test for IgM antibodies is used. Note that these antibodies are not believed to persist, but IgG antibodies are believed to persist for years, particularly in the case of a natural infection. ELISA tests are also used for HIV and many other diseases believed to be infectious, but they are subject to false positives due to similar illnesses, vaccinations, autoimmune disease, and many other things. Remember, they're antibody tests. They're looking for your body's reaction to a virus, not for the virus itself. And whether the virus itself actually causes that reaction is actually usually up for question. I got some really interesting information from WHO, the World Health Organization. They perform measles testing on samples they receive from around the world. First of all, there aren't many samples considering population. In 2018, there were 48,177 samples received from Africa, for example, of which 77% were negative on the IgM antibody test and another 3% equivocal, leaving only 21%. The percentage negative were similar for other regions, even higher for the Americas, 88%. Overall, the World Health Organization reported 82,000 suspected cases in Africa, of which only 55,000 were considered actually measles confirmed cases, and of which only 7.5K, that's less than 10%, were lab confirmed. Most were epidemiologically confirmed, which means compatible symptoms in an area experiencing an epidemic or somebody who's been in contact with somebody with the disease. 14,000 were confirmed just on the basis of symptoms. In the Americas, all cases confirmed were lab confirmed, indicating a completely different diagnostic standard. I also got an email from Joan, and by the way, she sent me her address, and she did get some of her bookmarks, or at least they're in the mail. She should have them by now. So it really does work, just like magic. If you send me your address and say something nice about the show, or even something critical, I will send you one or two bookmarks. Joan wrote, "I appreciated your show with Frederick Whitehurst. This was on forensic evidence. I mentioned to you before Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness." Mr. Whitehurst might have read her book. In addition to especially young black victims, and I should note mostly males, not getting a fair trial, a huge number of victims do not even get a hearing. They're told that if they plead guilty, they will be released. They do not inform the young victims that they will have a felony on their record, and if rearrested, they will receive draconian sentences. Alexander also points out how the African American churches, mostly now nonprofits, no longer play the supporting role they used to. So more and more young black victims receive less and less support in the community. This is definitely an interesting area, and I really do see incarceration as, I don't know if the real basis is racism. It might just be profit. It's very profitable to profit on the backs of black American men. They're worth to these corporations more in jail than they are out of jail. And the system almost guarantees that they can't work productively after because of the felony conviction. What It's insane for society to put so many young people in jail and then when they come out ensure that they can never be productive members of society. I don't know. I don't think anybody's ever really thought, well, a lot of people have thought about that. When I interviewed the Professor Vitali, he'd obviously thought about that, but I think most of the people who have power in the system don't think about things like that. Anyway, Joan continued, "Back to your October 1st interview with Frederick Whitehurst. You and he worked well together to inform your listeners of the common problems with the forensic units, not receiving related education, sometimes working solely to provide evidence for the prosecutor, the defendants often not having appropriate legal help, and not having their forensic scientists working to show defendants innocent, working to secure their jobs rather than providing the truth that might free the defendants, etc. You both also gave examples for how the approach might be changed, especially in regard to marijuana. This was an informative and well-rounded show." Thank you, Joan, for that positive feedback. I felt a little bit guilty about talking about marijuana because I really truly believe that it should be legalized. But I wasn't really talking about the forensic approach to determining marijuana as anything but an example. It doesn't really matter whether it's, hair that might have come from a victim, a blood stain, a bullet wound, fire evidence, whatever it is, it should be tested well enough that there can be a high level of security that it's actually useful. And I think what Frederick Whitehurst was trying to say is that if all you have is forensic evidence, you probably shouldn't convict somebody because there's no forensic evidence, even stuff that's been well tested, that is 100% certain. And it seems like the system is biased towards making sure that they get a conviction, which is not the intended purpose of the justice system. Justice system is supposed to convict people when the crime has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and that will mean that a lot of criminals go free, but it will reduce the number of innocent people who are sent to jail or even worse, sent to death row. It's a trade-off that we have to accept, but it appears that in reality, society, especially in more litigious places in the United States and is true around the world, society demands that there be somebody, there be a conviction. If there is a serial killer, let's put somebody in jail and let's hope that the crimes stop, because if we put the wrong person in jail, they won't. It is not a well-functioning system, to say the least. I got an email from Alex. I always follow your Facebook posts on the infectious myth, and I cannot begin to tell you how highly instructive they've been for me. I constantly hope that thousands of people will educate themselves more from your posts and interviews instead of placing their trust in the medical establishment's deadly machine. And to everybody, if you tell a friend about this podcast, that would be great. If you enjoy these episodes, if you find them interesting and challenging, then please tell your friends about them, especially people who might benefit from having an alternative opinion about medical and scientific issues in particular. So, no guest today. I thought I would get caught up on a backlog of reading that I've been doing on an increasing number of gender issues. Transgender women in sports, in theater toilets, in prisons. There's lots of areas, and I'm very interested in the consequences of over-medication. And this is where the transgender people are really suffering, is being persuaded to take medications that are going to do them harm. And as some of my guests who are more focused on psychology have pointed out, it doesn't even necessarily relieve their gender dysphoria, so they suffer the physical consequences of the drugs without eliminating the gender dysphoria. Anyway, let's get to it. I wrote to a neuroscience professor named Larry Cahill. He declined to be interviewed. He didn't exactly explain why he didn't want to do an interview. I don't know if it's something to do with my show or he just doesn't do interviews because he feels like he's taken out of context. I mean, my show is a little bit different because you hear the entire interview, less some ums and ahs if I need to reduce the length of the show. And sometimes I have a pre-discussion with a guest and that's not recorded. But basically, once I tell the guest that we're recording, everything they say is conveyed to you, my listeners. So I wrote to Larry Cahill. I came across your name and a reference to your work while reading a review of a book by Gina Rippon with a thesis that didn't make much sense to me. And I came across references to a similar book by Cordelia Fine, also promoting the idea that there are no differences between male and female brains. It seems to me that the mainstream media are simultaneously accepting and even promoting two extreme and incompatible views. One is that the male and female brains are identical, and because it's known that they aren't identical, then all those differences must be due to cultural programming and none due to the fact of being male or female. This theory seems to be widely accepted by the warm reviews of Rippon's book in much of the mainstream media. Basically, male and female brains are identical, and the mainstream media is endorsing this idea. But the second theory is advanced by transgender activists who say that it's possible to be born in the wrong body. What they mean is that their brain is female, but their body is male, or vice versa. And the only way to fix it is by physically changing their body to the opposite sex to concord with their brain. Basically, it says that male and female brains are dramatically different. This theory seems to be also accepted by the media, politicians, and progressives who agree with statements such as transgender women are literally women, despite the fact that this is saying the opposite of the Rippon and Fine theory. It seems to me, as someone with some biological training, that the truth is somewhere in between. Male and female brains can be different without men and women having to stick to rigid gender roles. Similarly, men who are very effeminate can express themselves without hormones and surgery, and this goes for women who have traditionally masculine traits. I'd be interested in knowing the science, or have somebody explain the science of how we know that male and female brains are different, because this is something that Larry Cahill has publicly stated, how we differentiate between the influences of genetics, environment, and culture, how much about what we know is physical, neurology, versus psychological. I know these are controversial issues, but I'm interested in the rather ridiculous lengths that various extremists can bring us to in their desire to make biology conform to their idealized world. And I'm interested in how the differences influence our choices as men and women, and whether giving identical environments and opportunities to boys and girls would result in men and women who made choices in 50-50 proportion. I.e., will we ever have 50% of men and 50% women in every? Dr. Cahill replied, "For personal reasons, I'm not interested in being interviewed. However, your instincts are correct. I will try to provide some information to help." Fine and Rippon are among a small but vocal group of people I call anti-sex difference individuals, most with little or no training in neuroscience, but who have been going around for about a decade now trying to convince people of something that neuroscientists know is completely false, namely that there are not ubiquitous, important, biologically-based sex differences in mammalian brains, or put another way, that the brain is not a highly sex-influenced organ when the evidence is overwhelming that it is. It's akin to creationists arguing that evolution is not well-supported, or anti-vaxxers saying it's not clear that vaccines are overwhelmingly beneficial. Just as a side here, I find it interesting that a neuroscientist would ignore problems with metals like mercury and aluminum vaccines. But anyway, I didn't ask him about vaccines. Their arguments work well with many people who don't know much or anything about the topic, except perhaps they'd like it to go away. I destructed their key arguments in a 2004 paper for the Dana Foundation, which he sent to me, and more recently in a Quillette article. I wrote it because the Rippon book, unbelievably to me and many neuroscientists, removed the imprimatur of editors in Nature. I also attach a couple of reviews written for scientists to help illustrate for you just how big of a joke it is to imply that mammalian brain does not contain meaningful sex differences at all levels of its function. Regarding the phenomenon of gender dysphoria, as it's formally known, transgender as it's now informally called, transsexual as it was long ago called, yes, there are two logically incompatible positions being espoused, often by the same people. When I teach on this topic, I discuss the case I call transgender. I point out that while nobody really knows what causes this phenomenon in a very small percentage of people, we ironically can say confidently what does not cause it, namely human cultural influences. I have the students consider the fact that literally everything in this person's cultural experience since birth, up to and including winning a gold medal that only a man can win, there is no female decathlon, tried and tried to convince the person that they were male, and it all failed. The transgender phenomenon shows just how powerful biologically based and resistant to cultural influences must be one's sense of sexual identity. There's another logical corner that the anti-sex difference crowd has painted them into. On the one hand, that they insist that it's bad to study sex differences, especially in the brain, and on the other hand, they argue that it's bad not to study sex differences by studying only males. And he gave a link to a John Oliver film clip, which is kind of interesting, and it actually includes a short interview with this scientist. I believe most of these folks have not yet thought carefully about their views to see the contradiction. Last point. It really does not matter what folks like Fine and Rippon and the editors who love them say. Neuroscience, and indeed all of medicine, is now irreversibly waking up to the reality of sex influences of all sizes on functions throughout the body, development that is especially good for women. I hope that this helps. Signed, Dr. Cahill. So if the articles that he sent, one from 2014, to summarize, he said that animal tests for medicines generally only use male animals. An example of the problems with this, in 2013, the FDA cut the recommended dose of Ambien in half for women, acknowledging that women had been overdosed with this drug for years. The article that he sent acknowledges, challenges the assumption that the brain is a sexless organ, that the sex of the person or animal with the brain is irrelevant. On the other hand, he quotes Gloria Steinem saying, it is, quote, anti-American crazy thinking to do this kind of research, i.e. studying sex differences in the brain. One difference that he cited in the article is that, quote, the brains of women exhibit significantly stronger patterns of interconnectivity across brain regions, including across the hemispheres, than do the brains of men, which conversely exhibit significantly greater average connectivity within local brain regions, what the authors refer to as modularity. He says that the differences are strong enough that investigators can accurately classify brain connectivity networks based on sex with 93% accuracy. I think this debate identifies a fundamental contradiction in feminism. If you take the mantra from Annie Oakley, anything you can do, I can do better, there's the belief that the only reason men have performed better in certain areas is due to prejudice against women. For example, Andrea Dworkin, the radical feminist in 1974, wrote, the discovery is, of course, that men and women are fictions, caricatures, cultural constructs. As models, they are reductivist, totalitarian, inappropriate to human becoming. As roles, they are static, demeaning to the female, dead-ended for male and female both. We are, clearly, a multi-sexed species which has its sexuality spread along a vast fluid continuum where the elements called male and female are not discrete. The author of the article that included this quote interprets her as meaning that the move away from fixed dualistic gender will not be a reform, but a revolution in which the patriarchal man and woman will both be abolished. Dworkin also said, the real core of the feminist vision, its revolutionary kernel, if you will, has to do with the abolition of all sex roles, that is an absolute transformation of human sexuality and institutions derived from it. I've got to say that in these quotes, Dworkin seems to be confusing sex and gender roles, which are two completely different things. And I think when feminists criticize the pigeonholing of men and women into strict gender roles, they're really onto something. But saying that gender roles and sex are the same seems to be self-contradictory. Feminists, on the other hand, have pointed out that trials of drugs are oriented towards male consumers, and increasingly women are opposing biological males, transgender women in sports. So I think feminism has to come to grips with the fact that men and women are different, and then at some things men are going to be better, and at other things women are going to be better, that there are differences, and we're not going to have the same outcomes with women even if we give women and men the equal opportunity to do anything that they want. For many jobs, there isn't a lot of physicality, being a lawyer, a doctor, or an airline pilot, for example. But there are still jobs that include a lot of physical exertion, like firefighters, at least at times, athletes, certain construction jobs. And those jobs, it's unlikely that women will ever equal men in terms of the number of people in the jobs and in their capabilities in the jobs. But there may be, on the other hand, other jobs at which, when we look back, we'll realize that women, on average, are better. This is not to say that there shouldn't be women firefighters or women athletes or women in construction. That would be ridiculous. Women should have the choice, but the point is that women may not take the choices in the same overall pattern as men. So if we measure equality of opportunity by measuring equality of outcomes, we will fail because the outcomes may not be the same, even if we do have equality of opportunity. Women may not choose the same jobs in the same numbers, even if given the same opportunities. For example, graduates of psychology are mostly women, but computer programming still seems to be stuck at about 25% women. Is this innate sexism, or is it due to different choices that women as a population make, and is this related to their brain function, that there are tasks that they enjoy more, that they are better adapted to. It doesn't make the tasks that men prefer better, it doesn't make the tasks that women prefer worse, and it also, again, doesn't apply to individuals, it applies to populations. The fact 25% is a fairly large number, there's a lot of women who enjoy computer programming and are good at it, and they should still be encouraged to get into the field, but my only point is we may never reach 50% unless we artificially, unless we reach it artificially. Larry Cahill also sent an article from Nature Reviews Neuroscience, which is a much more hardcore science journal, and he described five what he called misconceptions about sex differences in the brain. The first is that the differences are small and unreliable. He claims that research clearly shows significant and stable differences, such as the analysis of the brain that I mentioned above. Another misconception, he believes, is average differences arise from outliers. In other words, a few exceptional men or women at one end or the other of the bell curve push the average in their direction. He claims there's no evidence for this idea. Third misconception, that differences within a sex or differences are greater than differences between sexes, therefore they are trivial. We could say the same thing about athletic performance. The difference within men dwarfs that between elite men and elite women. But still, if the differences were ignored and all athletes competed together, female athletes would essentially disappear at the higher levels of competition. Fourth, differences can be totally explained by hormones. Now we're approaching transgender territory. If someone goes on hormones, then presumably their brain would become the opposite sex. No, says Cahill, sex hormones cannot explain all observed sex differences. Plus, when a fetus and a child are growing, the hormones are doing most of their work when you're young, and it won't be undone if the hormones in the body are artificially changed later. Finally, another misconception he believes is, if there are no sex differences in a behavior, there are no neurological differences in that behavior. Cahill gives two examples where men and women perform the same at a task, such as in autobiographical memories and in naming images. However, the patterns of brain activity were quite different. So men and women performed the same, but got there in different ways. Cahill also notes that things like the menstrual cycle influence behavior and can change performance on verbal and spatial tasks. He also describes parts of the brain that are larger in women or in men. Another area of biological differences between men and women is the appearance of the face. I came across a 1993 study that showed that people could distinguish men from women with 96% accuracy when looking at a photo of a person wearing a swimming cap. The reason for the swimming cap is to cover the hair, which is often treated differently in men and women for social reasons. And this is presumably one of the reasons why some transgender women, at least those who have a lot of money or good insurance, will actually have their face rearranged by breaking bones and resetting them in order to look more like a woman. Going on to women's sports, in a September series of bike races in Steamboat Springs, a transgender woman, Jillia Bearden, cleaned up. In one race, this person lapped all the women. The gap in performance was that large. This is the new way for men who can't make it in men's sports to become world champions by just declaring themselves to be women. There's also a Canadian bicycle writer and professor, Rachel McKinnon, also a transgender woman who has also won a lot of races. The suspicion is that if they were to compete with their biological male counterparts, they would not be winning any prizes. In July, a transgender woman weightlifter, Laurel Hubbard from New Zealand, won gold at the Pacific Games. Hubbard lifted 268 kilograms, while the silver and gold medalists, biological females from Samoa, lifted 261 and 255 kilograms. Hubbard used to compete as a man, but had a pretty serious accident and is now 41 years old, but still may go to the 2020 Tokyo Olympics as a woman, and we will see what happens, as this may be the first Olympics where there are biological males competing as transgender women. The IAAF, the International Athletic Federation, is focusing, perhaps one might say obsessing, on testosterone and lowering testosterone levels in order to allow a transgender woman to compete with biological women. A new Swedish study has shown that there's a very little reduction in muscle strength in biological males taking hormones to reduce their testosterone levels. A quote from the abstract. Thigh muscle volume increased 15% in transgender men, biological women taking testosterone, which was paralleled by increased quadriceps, 15%, and radiological density. In trans women, biological males taking hormones to reduce testosterone, the changes were a 5% reduction in muscle volume and 4% in cross-sectional area, while density remained unaltered. Not surprisingly, transgender men increased strength over the assessment people, while, and this is a little bit surprising, transgender women generally maintained or slightly increased in strength. So despite the fact that they lost some muscle volume, transgender women actually increased in strength over this one-year period. So in summary, 1 year of testosterone-lowering treatment made no significant difference to the male bodies of transgender women. They actually got stronger despite losing a small amount of muscle mass. And although females taking testosterone did become considerably stronger, they did not approach the strength of trans women. Now, this was not a study of athletes, but there's really no reason to believe that it wouldn't have similar results. There's certainly no reason to accept that it wouldn't. So in other words, in the absence of evidence, the international athletic federations should be a little bit more conservative in allowing biological males to run or compete in women's athletics. One logical observation or conclusion is that transgender men should not compete with other women because they're clearly taking performance-enhancing drugs that have a significant impact on performance. One of my biggest concerns about people that want to transition from one sex to the other is the health impact on them, especially with young people. I don't think they're really mature enough to make these decisions. They're also not told what some of the dangers are. And in many cases, the evidence is not yet in, but people are being put on hormones and given surgery regardless. A new article in the British Medical Journal, September 2019, written by two journalists, is very critical of experiments with puberty blockers. These drugs are supposed to put puberty on hold. Some of the criticisms from experts in the field that they quote include the suppression of negative data, such as a significant increase in the number of children with suicidal thoughts. Some claims of certainty are cited as false, such as the claim that, quote, hormone blockers will make you feel less worried about growing up in the wrong body and will give you more time and space to think about your gender identity. The concern that although gender dysphoria resolves in most people given psychological treatment, almost nobody detransitions if started on puberty blockers. Almost all go on to cross-sex hormones, if not surgery. To take a little detour, there's also a Sky News UK article from October, this month, October 2019, claiming that there are hundreds of young trans people speaking to detransition to return to their original sex. It's very sad that once organs such as breast tissue or testicles are removed, the person can never fully return. And the article is based on the story of 28-year-old Charlie Evans, who wants to help other people in her former situation when she attempted to transition to a man. response of UK transgender rights organizations like Mermaids and Stonewall is to claim that it's not hundreds of people, maybe just one or two. They keep quoting less than 1%. But of course, we don't know that because there's huge dropouts in any study of transgender people. And one of the suspicions is that people who drop out either have serious problems like suicide, or that they just don't want to continue, so they stop seeing the doctors. The study that they are talking about in the British Medical Journal, to go back to that article, started in 2011 and was supposed to provide annual reports to HRA, the National Health Service Health Research Authority, but failed to do so. The study was also rejected by the first ethics board, but instead of modifying the study outline, they went to a different ethics board. All of the professional members of the second ethics board worked for the same organization as one of the organizers of the trial. One of the reasons for the initial rejection of the study by the ethics board was the lack of a control group. The researchers felt that nobody would enter the study if they risked having a placebo, but that implies that everybody believes that puberty blockers are beneficial, both the patients and the doctors already. But the reason for the study is that that's not known. And without the control group, the study doesn't help answer the question. It would be more responsible to attempt the study with a control group and see that if people were properly informed, that if they went on puberty blockers, there was no guarantee it would help and there was a risk of side effects, then maybe people would participate in either group that they were assigned to, whether it was the active drug, the puberty blocker, or a placebo. The article mentions the recent finding that bone density stops increasing after hormones start. Rather disturbingly, promoters of hormone treatment are noting that bone density did not fall, which is true, but it misses the point. The UK gender clinic GIDS, which is in the center of this debacle, even stated that, quote, reference ranges may need to be redefined for this patient cohort. In other words, if normal bone density levels are lowered for people taking hormones, the problems go away. What will lower the normal bone density do for the life of children or young adults after a decade or two or three? Apart from bone density, a 2018 article in Annals of Internal Medicine found that in trans women, venous thromboembolism rates were dramatically greater than in both non-hormone-taking men and women. However, doctors who do transgender surgeries are much more upbeat. Thomas Satterwhite, a plastic surgeon in San Francisco, is excited that mastectomies for gender dysphoria are now covered by insurance. He claims that he's performed them on 50 to 60 patients under 18 and some as young as 14. The operation, according to him, has minimal complications, unless regret of an irreversible body change is a complication. A new study published in September in Clinical Practice and Pediatric Psychology compared socially transitioned children against gender variant children living as their natal gender. They found no difference in psychosocial challenges between the two groups. In other words, no improvement with the affirmative approach, despite claims that lack of affirmation is literally killing us. And then if we go back to the British Medical Journal article, one of their complaints was the suppression of, quote, a significant increase in the number of children with suicidal thoughts. Intersex or DSD people have been carried kicking and screaming into the gender debates against their will because they're used to support the notion that sex is a spectrum, not a binary. The word is unfortunate, it's misleading, because most intersex conditions are not in between male and female. This condition is properly called hermaphrodite, and such people are extremely rare. Rarely it is difficult to classify children at birth as male or female, but usually a specialist can do it without a problem. Very, very rarely this is not so easy. For more on this issue, listen to episode 229, where I interview Claire Graham, who herself is intersex and advocates for intersex people and, like many, wishes to be left out of the transgender debate. Okay, crime and punishment. The police in Ontario, Canada, the province which is home to about one quarter of the country's population, will no longer publicize the gender of people charged with crimes. The simple solution would be to release the sex of the person. This perhaps is better than recording a sex crime committed by a transgender woman as a female crime when it's actually committed by a fully male-bodied person. Part of the reason is that driver's license no longer records sex, so the police officer needs to make a judgment call, which will not always be easy, especially in dark and noisy environments. Prisons. The first transgender woman, a biological male, to be transferred to a Canadian women's prison was Fallon Obey in 2017. The problem is that increasingly, transgender women still have male genitals, male aggressive impulses, quite frequently a history of sex crimes, and are often sexually attracted to women. The sex crimes, obviously, are usually against women. In 2018, this Canadian experiment became policy, and self-identification is all that's needed. In other countries such as UK and Ireland, this has led to rapes in prisons. And I hope my next episode will be on this specific issue. In Scotland and the UK, policies such as in prisons that make it easier for transgender people to legally change their gender have been put on hold. Increasingly, women are pushing back against policies that will see male and female bodies mixed in toilets, prisons, rape crisis shelters, and other places where women are vulnerable. It would also allow males to compete as women in sports and to win prizes, scholarships, or grants that have been reserved for women. Speaking of toilets, there's a little bit of a dust-up at the famous Old Vic Theatre in London, England. They raised money to double the number of women's toilets. Due to different biology, women need stalls and take longer to urinate, and also have to deal with issues related to menstruation and pregnancy. So now the theater stalls will be identified as with urinals, formerly the men's, and stalls only, formerly women's. A good article describing how insane this was published in the magazine Stage that covers theatrics and the theater industry, but it was then pulled by the magazine and republished in the right-leaning Spectator. A lot of women are hopping mad, and I predict this policy won't last too long. Among other problems, the women feel that their donations were taken under false pretenses. They were told they were for more women's toilets. The author of the article in the Stage, well, now the Spectator, makes a good point that the policy opens up all toilets to men, while women can only access half the toilet stalls unless they don't mind walking past a row of men with their penises out at the urinals. Women also may want to do things related to female biology, such as menstruation or even rearranging a bra without men staring at them. Plus, there is the issue of men entering with cameras intended to take photos of women, the perversion known as upskirting. It's not even clear that this makes life better for transgender women. If they are harassed by men for violating gender norms, they are still going to be in the same washrooms as men. Adding a few single occupancy rooms for people who feel uncomfortable in front of others for any reason, which could be as mundane as having to change an infant with a dirty diaper, or being transgender, or like a lot of men, being unable to urinate when standing in a public space. It's a problem that doesn't get talked about too often, but does occur with a lot of men. This month, October 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court started considering the case of a long-term employee who was fired at a funeral home when they came out at work as a transgender woman and wished to dress according to the female dress code at work. I think it's wrong to fire someone because they are gay or transgender, but the problem with this case is that it could enshrine gender identity as a protected class, which is in direct conflict with sex as a protective class, and could result in the erasure of women's right to public spaces. It seems that once gender becomes a protected class, sex essentially loses its status as a protected class in practice. As the Supreme Court has been stacked with conservatives by Donald Trump, the chances of a decision in favor of the transgender woman are extremely low, especially because currently sex but not gender identity is protected. It would be possible for the justices to accept that Amy Stevens, formerly Anthony Stevens, really is literally a woman, and therefore sex discrimination laws apply to her as a woman. However, the chances of this with such a conservative court are close to zero. It seems likely that the Democrats will bring the Equality Act forward, which will enshrine gender identity as a protected class, unless progressive women wake up and start protesting. I don't think the protests of conservatives are going to cut much ice with the Democrats. I don't see anywhere as much awareness of the sex-gender conflict in the United States as at present. In Canada, more people have been woken up by the Jessica Jonathan Yaniv situation, despite the muted coverage by the mainstream media. So, what do I think now? Well, today I agree with gender-critical feminists. Some in the past tried to erase sex differences in pursuit of equality. And even today, this is happening with the so-called intersectional feminists, who are very supportive of transgender rights because they don't see them in opposition to women's rights. Equality is a laudable goal, but the path of denying biological reality was always simplistic, although at the time its advocates did not understand that it would create more problems than it solved, that if it was used for women to claim male privileges, that it would also be used by males to claim female privileges. Women should get the same rights as men, not because they are the same as men, excepting genitals, but because they are equally human. The problem is that progress is harder to measure if we accept biological differences. Equality of opportunities will not result in equality of outcomes in every field, which is actually good for people who work in gender equality because they can never succeed, therefore their continued employment isn't threatened. For example, far more women than men are graduating in psychology, similar numbers in law and medicine, but still a much smaller fraction in computer science and engineering. Is this because these fields are particularly misogynistic, or because women are less likely to want to enter them? Or perhaps a combination? How can we ever know for sure? Are fewer women cracking the glass ceiling because two things are true? Men in power are resisting the incursion of women, and more women decide that they don't want to devote almost all of their energy to a corporation and would rather have a more balanced life. Feminists who pushed the simplistic notion that men and women were identical, save genitals, wanted women to get access to the privileges that men had for so many years, millennia in some cases, reserved for themselves. But they did not realize that if sex was fluid, men could also demand the privileges that society had granted women. It might not have seemed a privilege to have women-only sports. In fact, some women, perhaps not so well-versed in human physiology, might have seen it as a prejudice that women couldn't run with the big boys, for example. But now that the female privileges are being lost, both to men who are genuinely confused about their sex, as well as to men who just want to gain access to women's bodies, the understanding that they are indeed privileges worth fighting for, and the negative consequences of losing them, are becoming more widely understood. If we accept biological reality, we see that women need accommodations that men do not. There need to be special privileges accorded to women to protect them, such as separate toilet and changing facilities, women-only prisons and rape crisis shelters, women-only sports. It doesn't mean that women shouldn't get equal access to university entrance, or to the vast majority of jobs that don't have extreme physical requirements, and so on. Even though I predict that even if women have complete freedom to choose, they will not, as a population, make the same choices in the same proportion as men. Gender restrictions can be removed, but I also predict that most men and women will still willingly adopt some traditional gender roles, such as more women than men voluntarily staying at home to play a larger role in the upbringing of the children that only women can bring into the world, and for which only women can produce the perfect initial nutrition. The key is freedom to choose. There's nothing wrong with stay-at-home dads, nor families where both parents continue to work after children, any more than there's a problem with male nurses or female doctors. Gender roles should be chosen, not prescribed. There's also a need for some special accommodation for men, as boys are now struggling in school, have a greater risk of suicide, and so on. We may see in the future that special programs for boys and young men need to be developed to try to encourage more into certain fields that have become woman-dominated. On the other hand, transgender activists and their allies are trying to deny biological reality and deny women these special accommodations just by their mere presence. And they are implicitly reinforcing gender roles. Rather than saying that a woman can wear pants, cut her hair short, work as an auto mechanic, and still be a woman, transgender activists are implying, especially to vulnerable children, that they must literally become a man if they have any stereotypical masculine attributes, and vice versa. The most terrible price is being paid by the vulnerable children who are being led by the Pied Pipers of hormones and surgery into a future that probably will include devastating health consequences. And once they cross the first bridge of puberty blockers, they will find it hard or impossible to cross back. And certainly after years of cross-sex hormones and surgery, the bridge back will have been burned to the ground. It is a big lie to say that everything can be undone. A profitable lie, but a lie nonetheless. Thank you for listening to episode 233 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to infectiousmyth, one word, on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.